Hi, and welcome to this episode of Ann Arbor AF. I'm Jess Lita, and I'm here with co-host Molly Kleinman. We both use she, her pronouns. Molly and I think a lot about how to make cities better through affordable and abundant housing, safer transportation outside of cars, and community safety beyond law enforcement. We talk about these issues because we know whatever we're trying to accomplish, we can't do it alone. So we're right here with you, learning how to get informed and then get involved. It's your city. Let's jump in. Today we're talking with Jenny Schutz about her book, Fixer Upper, How to Repair America's Broken Housing Systems. Jenny is a senior fellow at Brookings Metro and is an expert in urban economics and housing policy. She's the author of Fixer Upper. Before joining Brookings, Jenny worked at the Federal Reserve Board in Washington, D.C. and taught at the University of Southern California. Before we get into the conversation, Molly's going to do some election reminders for us.
Just a real quick reminder that Election Day is coming up on November 8th and absentee voting has already started. So you could, if you have your ballot already, you can fill it out and send it back. It's not too late to request a ballot. Our episode last week gave lots of recommendations for who to vote for on local races, and also the state propositions and the climate millage. We both came down pro climate millage in the end, and you can listen to our episodes about that as well if you want to get like deep into the details of it. It's also not too late to volunteer for any of the campaigns that you care about. They need volunteers, especially the weekend before the election and on Election Day. So even if you only have 1 or 2 days to spare, you can get out there and knock on doors and drop literature, and it will be a big help. So now, thank you so much, Jenny, for joining us today. We are so happy to have you.
It's exciting to be here with you.
I'm wearing my legalizing housing t-shirt, and I feel like I'm wearing the band's t-shirt to the concert. It's like, ah, we're here. We're talking about the thing. So I wanted to kind of ground this conversation in why you and why Fixer Upper. And it's because I view this, your book, as a necessary complement to Color of Law and Race for Profit, where Color of Law gave us a deep historical examination of the racist underpinnings of our legal structure and our legal decisions. And Race for Profit did a devastating but admirable job at outlining the private policies that kind of complemented that. What you do is you go beyond those into offering solutions, which I desperately wanted from both of those books. And you also, and I appreciate you doing this before you knew me, put a little love letter into the introduction to organizers. What you said about housing is that a coherent national movement has yet to take hold. Building political coalitions between younger, racially diverse renter households with affordable housing advocates could achieve broader, more durable policy improvements. So those are some of the reasons that I felt like a conversation with you would be A, fun, and B, really productive. So what I wanted to start with is you are really looking at your book at national systems. I'd like to tease out what might be unique for smaller communities, say a college town, what regulatory challenges or landscape are unique to places like this.
Yeah, and one of the things that's fascinating about talking to local groups about the book is that almost every locality is kind of a microcosm of the national problems. So the issue of not building enough homes, diverse kinds of homes at different price points in the right places, that's almost universal. Building too many homes in places we shouldn't be building them, that's almost universal too. Some of the generational tensions about who can buy a house and put down roots in a community and not, that's present almost everywhere. But I will say that college towns have maybe two or three features that are common across most of them and that are particular and often very hard to solve. One is that the demand for housing in college towns is really unusual, that you've got generally students and faculty who are willing to pay a premium to be very close to the university to accommodate their schedules. And so you've got this very strong demand, students who are often willing to live in group houses, so pack lots of people into a space, which means they can outbid non-students who don't want to live like that for the same spaces. You've got big institutional landowners, the university, which has often very deep pockets, a very, very long time horizon, doesn't operate like a market landlord. So they may have, you know, like a giant quad on super expensive land that somebody would love to build, you know, housing and shopping centers on, but they'll never sell it. So that makes the land very inflexible. I will say also that some of the longstanding faculty who've lived in these communities tend to be a little on the NIMBY-ish side. And so that distorts the local politics a lot. So you have kind of all of these dynamics wrapped up together. And, you know, also the college town provides a lot of jobs, but is not usually the entire region. So you've got spillovers with the neighboring communities. Sometimes the neighboring communities have maybe more land that they could develop, but they operate independently of the college town and of the university. So it's very hard to kind of coordinate and get to a well-functioning regional housing market.
You know, it's interesting, in starting to have these conversations, we talked to Aaron Lubeck from Durham a couple of weeks ago. I got a couple of reach outs on Twitter from folks who I won't name, who reached out in confidence, who felt this tension. They work for a university, they themselves are in college towns, and don't want to advocate publicly for housing because the folks who manage them, right, like folks higher in the administration and their department, are very publicly opposed. And they really feel a tension between their own political leanings and their professional needs and how they feel like they need to perform professionally. And that was the first time that specific tension occurred to me, but it looks like it happens in multiple communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think we tend to forget, we sort of assume that all the people who work at universities are like full professors who make a ton of money, and most of them aren't, right? Most of the people who work at universities are staff. These are like, you know, the administrative assistants in the departments and, you know, people who work in the dining halls and the dorms and all of the support staff. They generally don't make a ton of money, and they are some of the people who have the hardest time affording housing within a reasonable commuting distance of their jobs, right? Many of them actually wind up working odd hours, right? So like if you're then the janitorial staff and you clean dorms or you work concessions at the football stadium, you work really strange hours. You may really want to be close to your job and have a short commute, but you also can't afford to outbid, you know, six students who come from wealthy families and are, you know, buying up group houses close to campus.
You know, what you're talking about, one of the things that I've been a little bit frustrated by is that living in the backyard of a university whose program I matriculated out of, you know, whose scholarship I largely admire and appreciate, mostly ignore Ann Arbor. And I feel a little bit like the, the shoemaker's kids, right? We're not the sexy one to pay attention to. So my next question, I want to ground a little bit. I'm thinking about the fact that actual redlining maps, like the literal redlining maps, are limited to cities of a certain size or larger. And what that does is allows places like Ann Arbor, in the absence of any other information, to point to that lack as having always been on the right side of history, when in fact, we know better. And I think in the North in particular, and I'm saying this as a Southerner who moved to the North and was like, yay, I escaped racism. And then I was like, oh, wait. Northern communities outside of the Jim Crow South often point to the lack of Jim Crow laws as a lack of discrimination, when historians, and more importantly, folks with lived experience, can point very consistently, you know, to the discriminatory experiences that they've had. How can we be racist, the logic goes, when we've obviously never done racist things? And what I'm saying is there is a lack of scholarship often around, especially around the history and the policy history of places like this. So I'm curious if there's anything that you can speak to about the gaps in scholarship or research that would help smaller municipalities and rising to meet these challenges. I had two questions lined up, but I think I'll stop there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great point that a lot of the research on certainly urbanism focuses on the big cities and focuses often on places that are the worst. And even things like the research that we have on zoning and places that have really exclusionary zoning, which we know makes it hard for low-income households and particularly Black and brown households to move into some of these high opportunity communities, most of the research that we have is on big cities, and it's on places like California and Massachusetts, which we know are terrible, right? But like, nobody's written the history of zoning in Ann Arbor, or, you know, for that matter, in like Chapel Hill or in Ithaca. And so we kind of have a blind spot on a lot of these places. And I hear what you're saying about, you know, sort of the North likes to think of itself as we didn't have Jim Crow laws and we're not Birmingham, therefore we're okay. I lived for 7 years in the Greater Boston area, and, you know, Greater Boston had some horrific fights over desegregating schools through busing. You know, it's all of the small towns, many of which think of themselves as very progressive outside of Boston, but because they are really small and they all run their own school systems and the housing is really expensive, you know, there are no Black families who live here. It's not that we wouldn't welcome them. Well, yeah, but like, how many Black families can afford a $2 million house? So, you know, you're kind of excluding people indirectly and then patting yourself on the back that you're actually very progressive and virtuous.
That sounds so much like Ann Arbor, and in particular, the schools and the school segregation issues, which is like, I can go off on that for a long time, but Ann Arbor didn't officially desegregate its schools until the 1980s, and it was under threat of a court case. And my inclination is to put desegregate in air quotes, because our schools are still quite segregated. And the ways that housing segregation has shaped that, like, you know, it's pushed people of color into certain neighborhoods. And it also means that we do, even within the city, we do a little bit of this busing. So if you look at the school maps, there'll be like a random island of Burns Park kids who don't live in the like very wealthy central Burns Park neighborhood, who they're zoned for Burns Park and they're getting bused in. But most kids who go to the school can walk there. And so like, even within the school, you then have this divide between the kids who are nearby and within the neighborhood and the kids who are getting bused in. But people don't talk about Ann Arbor as a school that, as a system that uses busing to solve the segregation problem. And I have so many thoughts and feelings about the way this plays out, especially given the schools my kids go to. But I think what this brings us to in terms of your book and your work is around these intersections between housing and schools and housing and transportation. And you talk so well about how these things are all connected, but I'm wondering if there are particular details, again, like in those smaller towns that you see as distinct from other places.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the really important takeaways of the book, is that housing outcomes that we see are really tied up with a lot of the other policies that we have that aren't explicitly about housing, right? So mm-hmm. I focus a lot on, you know, the role of zoning, which affects how much housing we build and how much it gets cost. But it's also really linked to things like schools, because schools are paid for by property taxes on the homes that we have. And so, you know, how valuable the homes are in a community affects the revenues that you have to pay for this. And a lot of places that don't want low-income kids going to the schools, and we can be pretty blunt about it, that's what they're trying to do, right? If the only homes you can build are worth $1 million, then you don't have low-income kids who live in your town and who go to your school, and you need to pay for their schooling, right? And so a lot of these decisions that local governments make about their schools and their transportation systems and, you know, investments in things like parks and sidewalks, right? All of this is tied together in sort of the neighborhood amenities. So when you choose a house, you're getting access to all kinds of other stuff. And, you know, the value of those amenities affects the price of the house or the rent of the apartment that you have, right? So we can, you know, either create opportunities for people to move into places with great public schools and great transit and great jobs and, you know, parks and great neighborhoods, or we price them out of it altogether because the housing is just really expensive.
One of the section subheaders that you have in your book, I just love how you've got a sense of humor that just leaks out on a regular basis in this one. And it was something along the lines of measuring how strict zoning is. It's like holding a moonbeam, which I appreciate. And you also talk at one point about how municipalities struggle to measure the impact of their housing policies on renters. And you call out, I think, three or four specific impacts that we know are happening, like who people choose to rent to, how frequently they're turning over, things like that. But we really don't measure and then act on them. So I'm curious if you were to recommend, especially, you know, smaller cities, college towns, to measure something new or measure something differently, what that might be or what that might look like, even if we don't necessarily have a tool for it yet.
So actually, one of the things that I would love local governments to think about more and measure is how long it takes to build homes, and especially homes of different kinds. So like apartments that people rent versus single family homes. Like, local governments don't actually track this. There's some points in the process. The developer asks for a rezoning or asks for a building permit. And when the building is completed, they do an inspection and give a certificate of occupancy that you're allowed to lease up or sell this to somebody. But an awful lot of the development process occurs before there's an official ask from the local government. So a developer may spend, 3 or 4 years talking to local officials and already doing community meetings and doing outreach and paying their civil engineers and their architects to come up with designs, trying to prepare the sort of, images of what the finished project is going to look like before they file the first request for a permit that shows up in the data. So when you talk to local governments and ask them, how long does it take to build an apartment building? And they'll say, oh, from the, building permit application to certificate of occupancy is like 18 months. And you talk to the developer and they say, actually, it's 7 years because I spent 4.5 years doing the pre-development stuff. And the reason the finished apartments are super expensive is because I've got, people on my payroll for 4.5 years in pre-development. And if we could shorten that time period by half, the apartments would be a ton cheaper. And local government officials go, I don't understand what you're talking about. I'd like them especially to pay attention to how long does it take to get a single family subdivision of homes for sale through the process? How long does it take to get an apartment building for rent through the process? Because my guess is in a lot of places, the rental housing takes longer and is actually more expensive because of all of this process and pre-development.
Yeah. Listeners, I need you to know that I'm dancing in my chair as Jenny is talking, because this is one of my favorite drums to beat. And this is one of the times that I want to point to Portland because of their design review board. Ann Arbor has a design review board, and it is an aesthetic arbitration of buildings that happen downtown. Portland's design review board is pointed at the city. They measure how long their processes take and how expensive they are. And they look at different development types. And the job of the board is to make recommendations to staff and to policymakers to help developments go through smoother, more predictably, more transparently. And so I would love to see, you're talking about what to measure. Oh, let's do that. Let's do that thing.
And this also feels like the moment to talk about the builder's remedy, which has been this hot topic this week on Twitter. It makes me think of pirates and act of grace and builders where you just call it out and suddenly they don't kill you, or suddenly you get to magically build housing where they weren't going to let you build housing. So builder's remedy is this policy in California that it feels to me like it came out of nowhere. I'm sure to you too, you've been watching all of the steps that got us to this point, where basically I'm going to explain it and then you two can correct all of the things I get wrong. A municipality in California, you have to have something called the housing element, which has to conform with state law around basically zoning and what you can build where and how tall things can be. And California has now passed some laws that say you have to be expanding the amount of housing that can get built in your town, and there has to be more affordable housing. And if cities are not complying, don't have a compliant housing element within a certain time frame, builders can just call out builder's remedy and build whatever they want, as long as it's 20% affordable, kind of. Can we talk a little bit about, I know California is special and not all of it applies to here, but I'm curious first if we could just understand a little bit better what that is, and then talk about what lessons there might be that we could bring into the college town context.
Yeah, and I'll I'll talk a little bit about the Massachusetts Builder's Remedy, because that's been in place for something like 30 years now. So we have a little bit more evidence about that. So in Massachusetts, it's called Chapter 40B, which references the state statute. If cities and towns have less than 10% of their housing stock that's affordable to households at a designated income level, then builders are allowed to override local zoning and build something that's not allowed under the zoning as long as it has at least 10% affordable units. And so the idea is the super exclusionary suburbs where the entire community is zoned for, you know, single family homes on 2-acre lot sizes and all of the housing is really expensive. Those are places where a developer could go in and say, hey, here's a parcel of land. It's zoned for single family, but I want to build apartments and I'm going to set aside 20% of those for low-income families. And the local jurisdiction gets an option to say, okay, we get that we're out of compliance with the state law, and so we're going to allow your proposal. But if the local government says, we won't let you do this, we're going to fight it, then the builder gets to go to a state agency, and the state agency essentially arbitrates it. And so the nice thing about that is local governments that absolutely don't want to build rental housing and anything that non-rich people can afford, there is an option for developers to go in there and build stuff that doesn't require the local government to play ball, right? And even the interesting thing is that there are some localities that are actually okay with that kind of development. They just don't want to go through the process of rewriting their zoning because that's really contentious and hard and takes a super long time. So they do what are called friendly 40Bs, where the developer's like, I want to build some apartments and some of them will be low income. And the community's like, yeah, great, go ahead and do that. That's better than us rewriting our zoning code and like having to fight through it. So it works on some level. And in Massachusetts, like we have enough time frame to see there are a bunch of 40B projects that have been built. So a bunch of rental housing in places that wouldn't have allowed otherwise. That's great. There's some designated affordable housing in pretty expensive places. What it doesn't do is fix the underlying zoning. So those places that have super exclusionary zoning still have super exclusionary zoning. They're still building less than they would otherwise. They're still more expensive than they would be. There's this like this little like loophole to it. So it's better than not existing at all. It's not as good as all of those places should rewrite their zoning and just like allow, you know, townhouses and apartments by right everywhere.
Right. So the thing about, and sorry, Jess, you can go ahead in a second, but the thing that I've seen folks sort of honing in on with the California Builder's Remedy is this idea of skipping through all of that process, that the Builder's Remedy is a way to circumvent all the stuff you were just talking about, that it takes 7 years to build an apartment building. It's like, the trade-off is like you have to build this affordable housing that maybe wouldn't have penciled, except that you're skipping the first 4 years of process and now you can afford to put in some affordable housing. Is that like accurate?
Yeah. I mean, how they would actually do the arbitration does matter, right? So in Massachusetts, there's still a process, right? The builder has to apply to the local government and be turned down to then go to the state and get the approval. So it's not like an overnight, you just, you know, there's a magic wand, you can go build it, but it's much, much faster than going through the normal process. And it gets you out, essentially gets out of potential litigation, which is really important. And even more so, I think, in the California context, because the State Environmental Quality Act allows for people to sue. So I think the Builder's Remedy in California would circumvent the State Environmental Quality Act.
Wow.
I'm not 100% sure of that, but if that is the case, that would actually be huge.
Right. Because of course, the Environmental Quality Act, as I understand it nowadays, like it was maybe intended so that you couldn't like build an asphalt plant in someone's neighborhood, but now people are using it to do things like block affordable housing and block bike lanes and things that we understand are actually good for environmental quality.
It's just, yeah, the California statewide environmental protection law was written so broadly that basically anybody can sue to stop any project for any reason, at least temporarily. Like it's really that bad. And so at the very least, you can slow down a project in litigation or even threatening to cause a lot. Like you don't even have to file the lawsuit. You just threaten to file the lawsuit. And this creates a whole lot of additional review and a lot of expensive process and often scares off projects from happening altogether. And yeah, like using an environmental law to block bike lanes is a great example of like, this is just failing at its primary purpose.
So this isn't exactly in that bike lane, but I want, this is a burning question that I have for you out of the book. One of your subsections is called, and this is for readers who are reading along, this is Overcoming the Limits of Localism chapter. There's a subhead that says policies popular with local voters may harm broader regional or national well-being. And we see that all the time, right? Like we're making decisions, we're protesting based on what's happening on our block or on our street. And we're not thinking about streets, first of all, streets as public goods, and housing as a regional infrastructure. So my question is really for policymakers, like how can we help elected leaders think through policies that are popular versus the ones that are harmful? Because it's really easy to do the things that people are asking for and harder to do the things that we know that we need, but take longer to implement or much less popular. But that as an elected official, that's really hard to get behind and stay behind. So how can we as a community help bolster people who might want to do the right thing, but might feel swayed by, let's say, the loudest voices?
Yeah, that's a great question. And every community is kind of wrestling with this. I think there are kind of three strategies that are emerging that can work. One is trying to change the decision-making process from a project-by-project decision to like an occasional citywide one, right? So if you think about instead of the community coming out to vote on every single apartment building or every single bike lane or bus stop that gets added, the city is supposed to make a plan at some point that is forward-looking. It says, over the next 10 years, we expect population to grow by X amount. Therefore, we need to add, a certain amount of housing. Let's look at our overall zoning and our neighborhood plans and bring them into alignment with the growth that we need. But once you have that zoning code and that, comprehensive plan or neighborhood plan, then that's the end of the community engagement process and projects that are allowed just go forward, right? So you do the community engagement for the citywide plan like every 10 years, and then stuff is just allowed by right, and people don't get to veto every project on a case-by-case basis. During the community engagement process, it's also really, really important to get people who will benefit from the changes to show up to the meeting and be heard. And that's the piece that's typically been missing. We have these project by project meetings, and everybody who shows up are the neighbors who have lived there for 30 years and who vote in every election and who call and write letters to the city council. And they're the ones who show up and say, yeah, I don't like it. We don't need apartments. We shouldn't change the character of the neighborhood. God forbid you cut down a tree. This will enhance global warming and cause gentrification all at the same time. We can't do this. You need to have people who show up and say, hey, I'm a renter and my rent is going up and I'd love to have more apartments so I have more choices. I'd love to have apartments in a neighborhood that I can't afford to live in now so I could afford to move there. Right. And part of the problem is that many of the people who would benefit most from these changes don't currently live in the community because they can't afford to, or their future generations who, don't even vote and don't exist yet. We'd like our elected officials to think about future generations and not just the people who are here now, but they often forget about that. And, but like having people show up at these meetings helps give them political cover, reminds them that there are votes on the side of change and not just against change. The third kind of level is to move decision-making from the local level up to the state level. And I'm going to put a little asterisk in this. That's what California has been doing, is taking away some of the power from anti-housing, anti-growth localities, and the state legislature creating a framework for builders to move forward, right? And to make the housing more diverse. The state level politics are not that easy. And so, fighting this battle of legislature instead of the city council doesn't solve everything. The other thing that I think is pretty important in states like Michigan is that we're kind of trusting that the state legislature has the best interest of localities and especially of kind of vulnerable populations at heart, that the state is trying to make things better for people who don't have the political power, right? So low income and, Black and Brown communities are often excluded from the local political process. If the state can weigh in on their behalf, that's helpful. If the state is not benevolent towards vulnerable populations, they could make it worse, right? And we can look at places like Mississippi, where, you know, the state chose not to invest in Jackson's water system. And, you know, if the state chooses to behave badly, they could actually make things much worse. And Michigan doesn't have the best relationship with its cities and its poorer communities.
Yeah. I mean, when you talk about that, the first thing that comes to mind to me is our emergency manager law, which was sort of more nationally known under Rick Snyder about 10 years ago, because it was an emergency manager who argued that Flint, the city of Flint, should switch water sources. And that was what led to the water crisis, was an external emergency manager who was prioritizing basically like getting the city's debts paid over the lives of the people who actually live in the city. And that's like, we see that played out repeatedly across the state of Michigan. The state's been draining the city of Detroit for like just bleeding it for decades and decades. And so I don't think we can look to the state here the same way. We also have the challenge when we layer on transportation again of being the home of the Motor City. Like, car brain is bipartisan here. And Gretchen Whitmer, our current Democratic governor, who is very important for a lot of reasons, is terrible on transportation. Like,
she ran on the platform of fixing the roads, and what she meant only thing she meant by that was for cars.
Yeah. And expand, like, we're still widening highways. And there was this like innovation corridor where there's like all this money going into this like very magical thinking project of a road that's gonna charge electric vehicles while you drive on them, like while you drive on it. And also it's going to be for autonomous vehicles, which is a thing that these things don't exist yet, but we're building a highway for them. Meanwhile, we don't have a train between Ann Arbor and Detroit. We barely have a bus.
If the Michigan state legislature wants to like preempt local government's ability to create protected bike lanes, that would be bad.
Right. And that's kind of already what we're dealing with when we have like MDOT roads, which are the Michigan Department of Transportation, controls some of the roads that go through our cities, and they don't let us make the safety improvements that we need on those roads.
They don't even make the safety improvements that they themselves recommend. They have a complete streets initiative and they just don't like implementing it like almost anywhere.
Yeah. On the transportation side, it's a little bit easier maybe to kick things upstairs one level further, because most of the transportation funding is actually passed through from the federal government. You know, and the Biden administration is trying really hard to provide more funding for non-car transportation, and also to use the transportation funding as a lever to get local governments to fix some of their land use. So they have these new pots of competitive grants. Local governments can apply for money, to do a new light transit or bus rapid transit or something. But in order to qualify, they need to show that they're going to allow, housing and retail next to the transit station, which is not crazy. We should have been doing this 30 years ago. So, they're moving in the right direction with the big pots of money they have, which are on the transportation side. But the same kind of logic applies. Like, I love what the Biden administration is doing. You could imagine an administration that is going to turn that around and is going to switch the transit funding back to being basically all about cars, and will limit local governments being able to do better things.
Right. So what I'm getting from this is that Builder's Remedy is not probably a Michigan specific, like, we're not going to be able to do that in this state for maybe a while or maybe ever.
That's probably true. Yeah, Builder's Remedy, as best I can tell, it's only done at the state level because it's really intended to equalize the burden of affordable housing in some ways across different political jurisdictions, and to take back some of the authority of local governments. I will say that, so I live in the District of Columbia, which is this weird, we're a city, we're kind of a quasi-state. And I actually really like one of the things that our mayor has done, which is to set forward a goal, a quantitative goal for how many housing units we need to build based on their expectations of growth. And like, did this publicly, we need to build 36,000 more units by 2025. And the really key thing is, she said, every ward, every council ward has to build some. So the super affluent places, that haven't built any housing in 30 years have a target. They have a number they're supposed to hit, both for overall housing and for below market rate affordable housing. And once you have those numbers, like whether those are the right numbers or not, there's a goal out there and then you can measure it. Like either we're making progress or we're not. Some of the neighborhoods are making good progress on their goals and some of the neighborhoods aren't building anything. But having this, you know, a city like Ann Arbor could do this too. And balancing this across neighborhoods to make it clear, nobody gets to opt out. Nobody is going to be, you know, preserved in Ann Arbor and immune from growth. I think that sets a really important expectation.
I need to give myself a little Jenny flavored high five here because I did a mini Twitter thread on Builder's Remedy in Ann Arbor. And what I said was, we don't need that. What we need are targets. So thank you very much for, again, like speaking directly to me. Appreciate that.
I'm speaking directly to your city council members, actually. Give yourself a target, hold yourselves accountable.
Yeah. Speaking of city council, I know that you guys are going to run out and get copies of Fixer Upper. We'll tell you at the end of the episode how to do that. Read the whole book. Feel free to skip to page 160. It's a table called An Action Plan to Fix America's Housing Systems. It's like a cheat sheet. So just get the book and read the table, but like read the whole thing too.
It's also just a very good and very readable book. As someone who struggles to read nonfiction, I was like flying through it when I finally picked it up. So
there's an audio book. So if you're sitting in your car in Michigan, driving around doing your errands, you can be listening to it. You can have my thoughts in your brain.
Yes. Do it.
What an excellent plug.
Yeah.
Get Jenny in your brain.
It's not my voice, but it's my words.
Yeah. All right. I'm looking through, listeners. I have Fixer Upper. It's post-it noted. There's highlights on every page. And really, I just kind of had to pick and choose, what I wanted to ask about because the real answer was everything. Ooh, I know what I wanted to ask that wasn't in the book. Okay. Jenny, what's your favorite report to read?
Well, the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard University every other year puts out a report called The State of Rental Housing, and it is a page turner. It has all of the information you ever wanted to know about rental housing. It's a little bit on like the horror genre or the tragedy genre, because it's usually on the depressing side, but it's super, super helpful. It's a nationwide overview focused specifically on rental housing, which is really important because a third of Americans rent their homes and low and moderate income households are much more likely to rent than own. So like this is squarely in kind of like the equity space. And it gives you a lot of trends that are really helpful for understanding what's going on in the market and calling out sort of what are the areas where we're not making progress? What are some of the causes for this? So that's should definitely be on your must read list.
Oh man, I love that. Earlier this year, I did a top 10 list of my favorite municipal reports. So that was on my list of things to ask you. And one of the cool things about the Joint Center is when they issue new reports, they do a live like webinar, and generally it's a panel conversation about the contents of the report. And your description of it as horror/tragedy genre is hilarious and also devastating. I live tweeted the last release of the rental housing report, and it ended up just being like this rage tweet storm. And I think I had like 50 in there, but it was so quotable and it was extremely juicy. And it is kind of a cattle call of issues with rental housing in our country. But to me, it also increases the urgency of talking about getting renters on our boards and commissions, getting renters elected, forefronting renter issues in a way that I'm excited Ann Arbor is moving in that direction. We do now have a whole renters commission, and they just started meeting a few months ago, but they're learning how to look at Ann Arbor's kind of legislative landscape from a renter-oriented perspective. But just bringing us more in line with our goals and our stated values, right? Like we say, and Ann Arbor really wants to believe that we are on the side of our vulnerable neighbors. And I think in our hearts we are. But when it comes that space between where we have the vision and where we make the plan is a tense space. And we do not always land on the execution of the plan on the other side of it.
Yeah. And I mean, Ann Arbor is in good company, bad company in that regard. You know, most of our big cities are majority renter, and even a lot of, you know, certainly a lot of college towns, a lot of smaller communities have big renter populations. Some of my favorite group of political scientists, Catherine Einstein, David Glick, and Maxwell Palmer out of Boston University, have done just a fascinating study where they dug through the personal financial disclosures of elected officials for local, state, and federal agencies, and categorized all of the elected officials as either owners or renters. And the astonishing thing is that even in majority renter cities, the vast majority of elected officials are homeowners. And some of this is just like people run for office when they're older, when they're a little bit wealthier, when they're more established. But, you know, like the people who run cities own homes. And actually, one of my favorite sort of examples of why this matters came in the last New York City mayor's race. New York Times asked all of the mayoral candidates to guess what the median value of a home was in Brooklyn. And like, they're all homeowners who bought their house 20 years ago when it was a lot cheaper. And so they're going, yeah, I think the median house in Brooklyn is like $300,000. They're like, actually, it's just shy of a million. So they were all off by a lot. And it's like, if you're a renter, you know whether your rent is going up and you know what it costs to buy a house because you've been looking. And so you're more conscious that this is a problem and that something that needs to be dealt with.
Yeah. Even Ann Arbor, which is not that big, is majority renter. Right. We're like, it's like 55-45.
Close to 55%. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I want to fangirl an entire chapter in your book. And then I want to call out a Twitter question that somebody posed right before we recorded. So thank you on behalf of somebody who has said on this podcast that home ownership is not my ministry. I want to appreciate you for chapter 5. Home ownership should be only one component of household wealth. That's all I want to say. I want readers to go in and read this and understand this and understand that when we're talking about housing as a public good, as a social good, we are often having different conversations about whether we're talking about housing as a means for wealth generation versus housing as access to opportunity, right? Like proxy for access to schools, access to jobs, access to a community, a lively community that we want to be in. So for those of you who are a little bit stuck on this idea and would like to learn more, please gravitate towards chapter 5. Okay. So,
I want to say really quickly about that. There are a couple of framings in that chapter. So depending on sort of what you lean on, like, I think it's not great that as a society, we sort of push everybody into home ownership. And, you know, this creates some of the really toxic politics we have with all of these NIMBY homeowners who are super protective of their housing values.
Your but phrase home voter was really like on the nose.
Which I didn't create. Bill Fischel invented that, but it's like, it's such a perfect description. But I think probably your audience will also understand the other framing, which is that it's not always the case that investing all of your savings in a home is the best financial decision for you, right? So like, think about the timing of the market and where you buy. If you bought a home in like Detroit or in Flint, right, you know, 20 years ago, you're like the equity that you invested in that home isn't going to build up as much wealth as if you had rented an apartment and put your down payment into like the S&P 500, right? And in some parts of the country where housing prices have actually gone down over time, you have less wealth today than you did before because you put it into a house in a neighborhood that wasn't appreciating, right? And like, if you bought a house in Flint, you're then locked into a community. You can't pick up and move someplace easily to someplace that has, you know, healthier drinking water. So people really need to be serious about thinking about, you know, how does this work for you? And like, this is not a solution for everybody, and we shouldn't expect it to be.
Mm-hmm. As with healthcare and women's reproductive care, we should be expanding options.
Right on.
Vote Prop 3, Michigan. Mm. Why is this even a question?
Vote yes. All the props, bottom of the ballot. Keep going.
That's right. Okay. So Melody Kramer on Twitter, I posed the question, we're talking to Jenny, what would you like to ask? And Melody Kramer, who's in the Chapel Hill, Carrboro area, said, I'm curious if there's research on how and when to engage in discussion threads on social media. if it's useful, when it's useful, what might be the most effective ways to engage?
Yeah, and I don't know if there's research specifically on the social media question. My guess is there are probably people in like the communications space who do that. I will say, sort of from my personal experience, engaging on social media can be really helpful to reach other people who agree with you and to know that there's a community out there, including things like crowdsourcing solutions to problems that pop up elsewhere. So like in the housing space, you know, there are lots of communities that have similar kinds of problems that are trying to lobby their elected officials, and learning what other places have done successfully is really helpful. And there's some networks specifically for kind of pro-housing advocacy groups. I would push you towards the Welcoming Neighbors Network and towards YIMBY Action, both of which try to connect groups and help them share success stories and learn from each other. And so Twitter is great for that. I will say, part of this goes back to our earlier question about how do you persuade elected officials to do hard things when they are unpopular? It's actually not always clear that the hard decision is unpopular in sort of a broad sense. It's unpopular with a handful of very noisy people, and they're very noisy people in person, and they're very noisy people on Twitter, but they're not always the majority, right? And so I think social media can be useful for sort of getting broader knowledge and awareness of an issue, reaching out beyond the handful of people who show up at Tuesday night and fuss about something. But there are also some new tools to help do like polling, right? So rather than just ask the people who live in a neighborhood, right, do a citywide poll, right? Our transit system, WMATA, finally started getting feedback on changing bus routes from people who ride the bus. Like they had staff who would get on buses and hand out little flyers of like, hey, you're asking people who ride buses what you want the bus service to look like, instead of asking people who drive cars what you want bus service to look like, which by the way, gets you a really different answer. So like your local planners can help think through how do you reach this broader community and engage with them. Students are a hard population to engage on local issues, because a lot of them think, I'm just living here for a few years. Maybe I don't even, I'm not registered to vote here. I'm registered in like my parents' hometown. But students have a lot to gain from some of the stuff that we're talking about, right? More affordable housing, more non-car transportation. If you can figure out a way to tap into those populations, and like that's probably a good group to reach on social media, you know, probably not Twitter so much, maybe it's on Instagram, but try to like do strategic outreach to the people who don't normally engage. And like social media is one of the tools to do that.
Yeah. I actually spoke, and the University of Michigan has an urbanism club of like undergrads who care about urbanist stuff. And they invited me to come speak like as transportation commission chair. And it was great. They're like, you know, they're in all different disciplines. It's not just the like planning students. And I, of course, gave them quite the lecture about voting and signing up for boards and commissions and all of those things. But I think it is really tough to get engage those students. And it's become a truism, at least in Ann Arbor, that students don't vote, and that putting a lot of energy into courting their votes is wasted effort. But even if they're not going to vote here, I think the point you're making is that there are other ways that they can share their opinions and their needs and help move the needle on some of this stuff.
And circling back to sort of, you know, like what elected officials are doing that's harmful, a lot of local and some state elected officials have made it really hard for students to register to vote in the place where they go to school. And that's kind of intentional because they're trying to get younger people to not vote. So like all of our systems are stacked in favor of older people who've been in a place for a really long time and, you know, have deep established roots. But, you know, younger people have different needs and preferences. And if we could get them to show up and vote and like vote the old folks out, we'd get some better policies.
True. And I will say, go ahead.
No. Go ahead, Molly.
We actually do, in the past couple of cycles, they've set up polling places on campus, and they've set up not just polling places, but a whole like city county clerk's office, like a whole go in, register to vote, get your ballot and vote sort of all in one place right on campus. However, our primary where the city council is decided is in August when they're not here. So,
and it's not just in August. There's no communication from the university about the primaries. There's only communication about the general. And while I support that, like, can we please do the both and? Can we please let students know that the elections that really impact them most, that decide, that get to decide where they live and how they get to school, are decided when they're not here? Like, can we amp up that communication to University of Michigan people, new president Santa Ono, if you are listening to this, can we please enfranchise students to vote in the primaries? It would make such a difference.
I mean, this is one of these little institutional details that in you know, like, I live in a city that's basically all Democratic. The entire decision that gets made about who's going to be running in the general is made in June. You show up at the primary, like, the winner of the primary is going to win in November, guaranteed. But, like, lots of people don't show up in June because their brain doesn't say, oh, it's June, therefore it's time to show up to the election. And this just, this is entirely stacked in favor of the incumbents who are already in power. And so they have no interest in changing the rules.
100%. And actually, you know, to your question, Melody, and to this question about elections, I've thought a lot about this as somebody who lives in a community that is also somewhat of a news desert. A few years ago, we were really only having conversations about development, A, at dinner parties, and B, in the comment sections of what news articles we did get. It was a trash fire. It was horrible. And I didn't want to yell at the people who were yelling like that. Like, it just felt so dysfunctional and so toxic. And the way that I've thought about it since I've been in community organizing around housing and affordability for almost a decade now is that in any given conversation, let's say there's 100 people who are affected, 2 are arguing for, 2 are arguing against, and 96 have no idea that the conversation is happening. I want to talk to the 96. I really want to get the folks who are affected but not involved. I want to get them informed and involved. I really want folks to come into the process, whatever the process is, even if it's dysfunctional. Understand how it works and then bring in your voice. And Melody and other folks who are struggling with that as well, your community, your situation, everyone is different. But my answer was not to have online fights with people with strong opinions. Mine, really and truly, I did create an online forum. It started as Ann Arbor Yinvi and went through a couple of evolutions and is now Ann Arbor Housing for All. But most of my work is done offline in relationship. That's really where I spend my time and my energy. And I have found that fulfilling, rarely exhausting, productive, not always with wins, but in terms of where I'm investing my time, my energy, and my love, getting the fuck off platforms that don't care about me and into a community that does has been really important.
Yeah. And Melody is really active in the kind of Chapel Hill area group, and they do a lot of work offline. But, you know, you're 100% right. You persuade people through relationships. You persuade people by having conversations with people you know, and by figuring out what motivates them and what they care about, and then tapping into that and tying into it. And I will say that I was pretty conscious of sort of the audiences I was trying to reach with the book, right? I'm not going to convince the hardcore NIMBYs, right? I mean, like, they're kind of lost to the conversation. People who are already on board with this, right? The 2 people who are in the conversation going, yes, we want more housing. You know, they don't need this. It's helpful, hopefully, to provide some backup, but, like, they're already there. But you're right. There's this huge mass of people who would benefit from different policies, from different outcomes, who aren't really engaged, who don't show up, who don't vote on this stuff. And a lot of them are persuadable. Like, that's who we need to be talking to and like explaining to them what it is that's broken about the current system, how our current policies are failing them, and how we can make this better. But until we get sort of large groups of people out and get them engaged with this, we're not going to beat the deeply entrenched forces.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, if policymakers in particular were to read one chapter from your book, which one would it be and why?
The first chapter, because it's basically a Cliff Notes version of the entire book. So I am trying to make this super easy. And actually, you can start with the table of contents, which each of the chapter titles is like a policy recommendation. There's that one table in the last chapter that's the list of all of the recommendations. I've tweeted that out, right? I'm not hiding the ball anywhere. Like, this is the policy recommendation. Pick it up and run with it. But the first chapter sort of captures all of this. And I think there are 2 things that are important for non-housing policy wonks to take away from that. One is just that housing is so deeply connected to all of the outcomes in our life that we care about, right? This is where you live. This is where your kids go to school. This is your access to economic opportunity. And as long as housing systems are broken, all of the other outcomes are going to be bad. And the other one is that this really is a system of a whole bunch of policies. Local zoning, climate, transportation policy, our funding for local public schools, our federal income tax policy, like all of this stuff layers on top of itself, right? And at the moment, many of these policy systems are pushing us towards bad outcomes. To get to better outcomes, we ought to change a whole bunch of them, right? So we need to change our federal income tax policy as well as our zoning policy, right? And understanding how these things are connected, I think, is really important, partly because they're also set by local, state, and federal. Like, you need to care not just about your local election, you need to care about your congressional election, you need to care about your governor, right? Your school board, like all of this stuff fits together.
All right. So y'all are already convinced. Jenny knows her shit. She knows what she's talking about. Go find more of it. She did an interview on the Suburban Women Problem podcast, which, by the way, what an awesome name. Well done, ladies. She also did a fantastic interview with Ezra Klein. Please go listen to it. Of course, we'll drop links to both of those in the show notes, as well as links to where you can find the book and a Brookings article, Dysfunctional Policies Have Broken America's Housing Supply Chain, just all of Jenny's many smart words. And Jenny, I wonder if you can take us into the end of this episode by reading the last paragraph of your book.
Reforming our current housing and land use systems will shake up the groups of winners and losers. Rolling back exclusionary zoning across enough localities to improve regional housing production and affordability will require affluent homeowners to accept changes in their neighborhoods, and local governments will likely have to cede some control over land use policy to state or federal governments or pay financial penalties. Providing adequate rental assistance to all low-income households and ensuring decent quality infrastructure to all communities will require well-off voters to pay more in taxes. Elected officials, from mayors to governors to the president, are understandably reluctant to deliver unpleasant news to their constituents. But the only way we can move toward a better future is to present Americans with an honest, direct assessment of our current problems and concrete proposals for reform. Get out and vote. Get out and call your local elected officials. Don't get onto Twitter fights, but have conversations with your neighbors. Let's get this done.
And that's it for this episode of Ann Arbor AF. Thank you so much to Jenny Schuss for joining us today. Go get her book, Fixer Upper. Listen to her other podcasts that she's done. Read those articles. She's fantastic. Also, you can come check out past episodes and transcripts of Ann Arbor AF at our website, AnnArborAF.com. Keep the conversation going with fellow Ann Arbor AFers on Twitter at the A2 Council hashtag and on Facebook in the Ann Arbor Housing for All Facebook group. And hey, if you want to send us a few dollars at ko-fi.com/AnnArborAF to help us with hosting, we always appreciate it. We're your co-hosts, Molly Kleinman and Jess Leetaw, and thanks to producer Scott Trudeau. Theme music is I Don't Know by Grapes. You can reach us by email at AnnArborAFpod@gmail.com. Get informed, then get involved. It's your city.